Lately, I've been using a new product that I really like. It's called Superbeads. It's based on Nobel Prize-winning research and the nitric oxide principle. Nitrates are converted to nitric oxide in the body, which is the secret to Superbeads activity. Call 800-738-2198 or go to intelligentbeads.com. That's 800-738-2198, intelligentbeads.com. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today we're with Dr. Thomas Gwilliams. He's a PhD, and he's Vice President of Scientific Affairs at Ortho Molecular Products, who has a very, very detailed understanding of the way that nutrition, diet, and lifestyle relate to human functioning. And he has turned his attention lately to the role of stress and the HPA axis. That's the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis in chronic disease management, and it's he's written this very sophisticated book, which explains how to interpret tests, some of the failings of commonly used tests for assessing adrenal function. Also, it's a comprehensive list of supplements and strategies for helping patients improve their health through better adaptation to stress. Is it possible, Dr. Gwilliams, that stress is pre-programmed, that stress can be pre-programmed in utero, or even can there be transgenerational effects? Now we're beginning to see that sometimes inheritance is not just from the parents, but it may cross generations.
Well, this is really one of the interesting components. I didn't cover this in a lot of detail here, but there's a special section here on epigenetics and the stress response. And what we are learning, and we're learning more and more of this, is that the amount of stress, whether it's metabolic stress or whether it's emotional kind of stress, and the amount of cortisol or the stress response that the mother experiences while the child is in utero, this has not only effect on the stress response of that child throughout their entire life, it appears, but then upon the metabolic consequences, because as we talked about, the HPA axis is involved in almost every aspect, circadian rhythm, metabolism, etc., inflammation. And so, yes, and this is perhaps one of the sort of cumulative effects of the growing stress in the human condition, especially in Western countries, but now really across most of the world. Interestingly, if you look at the cortisol levels in Amazonian, some tribes that have been almost untouched by humans, their cortisol levels we would deem as being Addisonian. I mean, very almost flatline.
Wow.
And their cortisol levels are almost non-existent. And now some people say, well, it's because they experience no stress. The stress response is really low. But there are other theories that say it's an adaptation to a need for a robust immune system, because cortisol, glucocorticoids, inhibits inflammation, also inhibits the immune response. And so there's a lot of different theories. They haven't done a lot of studies. They obviously walked into the tribe and told them to spit in some tubes, so that, I'm not sure how much they're going to be able to get out of long-term studies with these individuals. But nonetheless, we're learning a lot about the effects of chronic and generational stress effects on metabolism and, of course, the stress response itself.
So how does this correlate to clinical conditions? I mean, what could lead a person to believe that they might have a maladaptive HPA axis condition? I'm going to use that term instead of excess cortisol or low cortisol, because it's more complicated than just that. We say, oh, your cortisol is too high, your cortisol is too low. But I think it goes beyond that. It's just sort of like an imbalance or a disequilibrium of all these complex interactions that constitute homeostasis. That's a good word to use, homeostasis, right, which is proper adaptation to life's challenges and stresses.
So, the number of conditions, chronic conditions that have been linked with either what we might call an increased activity of the HPA axis or a decreased activity are quite a few, actually. Some of the obvious ones, Cushing's disease, where we see this increased activity, or Addison's, where we see this very low activity. These are typically going to be some organic issue or some autoimmune condition. But if you let me just
point out that this is where endocrinology begins and ends. I think classic endocrinology recognizes that at the extreme ends of the spectrum, if you have a massive overproduction of cortisol and you become hypertensive and obese and, you get a buffalo hump on the back of your neck as if you've been taking 100 grams of prednisone every day for 6 months, then you've got Cushing's. And if you're completely flatlined, if your blood pressure is 60 over palp, and, you're totally exhausted and completely debilitated and you could die, then you have Addison's disease. But it's the spectrum in between of intermediate forms of imbalance that concern integrated practitioners, correct?
Exactly, and this is where most of the people are, in the sense of trying to adapt to either some stressor in their life or to some metabolic issue, which is also stressing the HPA axis. In fact, one of the analogies I use is think of the stress response as the emergency vehicles using the road. When there's a fire and there's six or eight fire trucks coming down the road, they need to use the same road that you and I use to get to work. But what do? We pull off the side of the road and we wait for them to pass. And so they have the priority. So when you're under stress, the stress response is using the same road, the same pathways, the same metabolites, the same receptors that all the other cells need to do their normal business. And under stress, every one of those activities needs to be set aside so that the body can respond, so we can survive to the next event. And so if you continue to do that, that is respond to stress, then the normal functions of those cells are going to be debilitated in some ways. And that's where the chronic disease portion of it comes in. So in an extreme case like a post-traumatic stress, you have such a stressful response, cortisol levels go so high that the brain, in order to protect itself, down-regulates the whole stress response. So usually adult sufferers of PTSD have a low cortisol response because their brain is protecting themselves. Whereas people with...
this is kind of an interesting point. So in other words, on a standard test, somebody who's subject to inordinate stress, so I think we'd all agree that post-traumatic stress disorder represents a very high stress state, they might actually score low on a cortisol test because it's as if the brain is turning off the cortisol to protect itself from kind of getting fried.
Exactly. And so we see that, in a sense, we see that in the long term with people who've had long-term chronic stress. Eventually the brain, that's why I'm sort of trying to recorrect the nomenclature that this is an adrenal problem. We typically say, well, when cortisol is low, then the adrenal is just given up. But almost always, it's the brain that has said, I need to downregulate this stress response because over time, I am going to be harming myself.
Could this be called burnout? Response, could we refer to this as burnout?
I would call it, yes, I think that's the appropriate term, is clinical burnout, and it's almost always happening in the brain, which then, of course, the adrenal gland is responding to that. In the case of PTSD, we might call it like an overshocking of the system, so it's more of an immediate downregulation to protect the body. And ironically, these people often have high DHEA levels.
Right.
Low cortisol, high DHEA, and it's as an adaptive response. Unfortunately, that also is maladaptive, and they then, because cortisol, as with many things that we measure, we don't necessarily want it to be low or high. We want it to be correct. We want it to be at the right level.
So this actually leads to kind of a clinical dilemma, because if you base it on a test and a person's highly stressed and they show up low, and you try to jazz up their quote exhausted adrenals with tons of licorice, and you tell them to take a lot of salt and sodium to get their blood pressure up, and give them kind of a rev me up kind of protocol, it might actually be deleterious, right?
Right, and this is, I point out the fact that, I mean, we don't want to get maybe too far into the weeds, but at the, we think about the brain, at the brain level, there's the control, at the adrenal level is the production of the hormones, but at the tissue level, that is at the cells that, that are responding to the cortisol or to the DHA, there are so many different layers of adapting or managing the cortisol and the DHEA response, mainly the cortisol response in those tissues. So some tissues can upregulate or be more sensitive to cortisol, some less. And so in some cases where you're downregulated on cortisol, other tissues may have upregulated their response to capture whatever they can do with that little mm-hmm. cortisol that's there. And then if you try to then upregulate the cortisol real quickly or give them, you know, Cortef, or, you know, like you said, give them salt or licorice, you may end up over activating those tissues until they can readapt to the higher levels. So what I typically tell people is the longer someone has been adapted to a low cortisol state, obviously if they have a true adrenal insufficiency where they need Cortef to survive, that's a different story. But I'm talking about somebody who's got a chronic stress-induced hypocortisolism. You may want to consider a slow approach so that the body can keep readapting to the increasing levels of cortisol or to the management or changes that are going to happen in the HPA axis. Doing something sudden is very potentially problematic in those individuals because each cell in each tissue has readapted to whatever that new level of cortisol is, and you don't want to just change that very quickly.
Can cortisol make you fat?
So yeah, these are the big advertisements on, you know, cortisol. Cortisol right. is a fat storing hormone, and so clearly we see a long term effect of elevated cortisol and stress, and this is in animals and in humans, and increasing adiposity, special central adiposity, sort of the classic cardiometabolic type adipose driven situation. Interestingly, when clinicians often measure saliva cortisol in some overweight individual, they say, well, the cortisol seems normal, and I don't think there's any issue here. But this is sort of one of the issues. They need to be careful because there are enzymes that convert inactive forms of cortisol, which we call cortisone, and these enzymes convert that inactive form to cortisol. But it does it very effectively in fat tissue. So you may have a higher cortisol level if you biopsy the fat tissue than what you measure in the saliva, because the saliva glands actually have enzymes that convert the cortisol to its inactive form, cortisone. So sometimes you're kind of a little bit tricked into not seeing what's going on in the person because the saliva gives you a picture, but it may not give you the whole picture if you have a lot of this conversion going on in the fat tissue. So those are some of the nuances that obviously clinicians need to be aware of when they're doing these testing. But certainly stress related to adiposity, central adiposity especially, and a direct connection actually with eating certain foods, which we might call comfort foods, are clearly connected with the stress response as well, which obviously exacerbates the whole thing.
The weight problem, it's a vicious cycle. What about the impact of the cortisol on sleep? Because we have a lot of patients who have sleep disturbances. I guess it's a chicken and egg situation, right? Because sleep deprivation can elevate cortisol. That's been shown in experiments where they deprive people of sleep. But conversely, the prolonged elevation of cortisol may prevent people from getting into a relaxation state.
So, right, you see different patterns of this when you have people with traditional insomnia, which may be a melatonin issue or some sort of anxiety issue preventing them from sleeping. So where you see elevated, sometimes you'll see elevated cortisol levels in the evening. Most of these tests that are done, one of the last saliva samples you take is typically right before bed, or sometimes you'll say midnight, depending on, I mean, obviously people aren't supposed to wake up to take it, but right before bed. And oftentimes they'll see people that have, you know, their cortisol levels right before bed are actually higher than the one they took in the afternoon. And this is, sometimes you'll see this in people who have trouble falling asleep, or oftentimes if people are taking, let's say they're on a weight loss and they're really low carbohydrate diet, and they go to bed and they become hypoglycemic in the middle of the night. Well, the brain kicks in and says, hey, you're hypoglycemic, I'm going to help you, I'm going to raise your blood glucose, and I can do that by triggering the stress response. Well, when you trigger the stress response, it's also the wakening response, because, you know, cortisol rises in the morning. So oftentimes people that are on these super low carbohydrate diets need to be careful that they're not creating a hypoglycemic spike, or a hypoglycemic dip, I should say, maybe in while they're sleeping, which will then kick on the stress response, and it kind of be counterintuitive for their sleep.
Okay, that's a good point. So let's talk about ways of modulating the stress response. You talk about a variety of supplements in the book, The Role of Stress in the HPA Axis in Chronic Disease Management, in a very scientific way, looking at the rigorous, you know, not just looking at folklore and claims, but looking at the rigorous science behind the use of various supplements. So let's talk about licorice. What is licorice and what does it do?
So licorice root, it's the root component, contains a number of different compounds, which we call glycyrrhizin or glycyrrhetinic acid. And as it turns out, it actually, if you look at the compound itself, it actually looks very close to cortisol. It's a steroid-like compound, and it will essentially block or prevent the conversion of the active cortisol to its inactive cortisone. So it actually inhibits the enzyme that does that. And when you take, so, you know, people have found this out, you take, you know, licorice, when they used to make licorice root candy out of licorice, no longer, it's hard to find that nowadays, but it's sort of coming back. But when I say that, it's black licorice, and people would take a lot of that, and they maybe have some salt in their diet, and they would realize that they're getting so much cortisol building up in their body because it's not able to convert to cortisone. As it turns out, cortisol also binds to the receptors for aldosterone, and that then triggers the retention of water. So you'll see these people all of a sudden they'll start retaining
elevated
water,
sodium, high blood pressure.
Exactly, and so in the case that will only happen when cortisol levels are either elevated or normal. So as it turns out, it can be helpful to use licorice when cortisol levels are low, which will then help preserve the cortisol levels in the body. So this is often used when you have hypocortisol levels, and you know it can be used especially in the morning where you're trying to boost and keep those levels up. And so it can be used therapeutically that way. We don't really run into that many times where therapeutic uses of licorice root as a powder or licorice root as a liquid create some sort of a hypertensive issue. As clinicians should be aware, if you've got a salt-sensitive hypertensive individual, that using high doses of licorice are probably not going to be helpful. But when they have low cortisol levels, that's rarely going to be an issue. I should mention that there is a licorice root product out there called DGL, which stands for deglycerinated licorice. Take the glycerin or glycerin out. This is used typically for ulcers, other sorts of things, and because it doesn't have glycerin in it, it would not be helpful here. But it also isn't dangerous, meaning so it's one of the reasons people use it. They want to use higher doses of the licorice and not run into any of these other potential issues. So that's a different product and should be seen as different, the DGL form versus the regular licorice root.
And there's a whole category of supplements called adaptogens. So can you introduce us to that concept and describe some of them?
So adaptogens are essentially primarily herbs that have been tested over the years and have been defined actually mostly coming out of the Russian literature and some of the Chinese literature as plants that were able to help individuals or animals deal with a stressful situation. And a lot of these early studies were, you know, taking Russian soldiers and running them through the snow, and they found out that some herbs helped them recover better or run longer in animals, swim tests, these kind of things. And from those things, like what was originally called Siberian ginseng, we now call Eleuthero, or plants like Schisandra or ashwagandha, and rhodiola, some of these, almost all of these grow in Siberia, or some sort of really difficult environment. And as we've studied them more, we realize that they have an effect on, well, we don't know all the effects, but we clearly have found some of the effects and molecular effects on proteins that modulate the stress response. A set of proteins we call heat shock proteins, which are actually stress response proteins that help modulate modulate the stress response. And several of these adaptogen and adaptogen metabolites have been shown to increase or modulate the expression of heat shock proteins. Most of them are anti-inflammatory at some level. And I actually go through some of the specific research in the book, not only the mechanisms, but some of the research that have been shown in humans to help people adapt to stress. It's a very difficult set of experiments to do because measuring stress in humans is a little bit non-specific. So a lot of these are non-specific, and so measuring them becomes very difficult. But the data on them are growing and very interesting, and of course are very consistent in the way they work in animals and in humans.
How about the things that are designed to manage cortisol? You know, sort of the buzzword is like you have high cortisol, and so how can you get your cortisol down? Obviously, you know, chill out, relax, do yoga, meditate, you know, see a psychologist, you know, do talk therapy, straighten out your life, and so on. Don't have six kids, you know, advice like that. or don't undertake, you know, scholarly tomes like The Role of Stress in the HPA Axis, which involves like 10,000 references. Nonetheless, there are some supplements that are geared towards helping people manage their cortisol, and you mentioned several of them.
So, right. So, the idea of reducing cortisol, you want to be able to tell the brain to shut down. And so obviously, like we mentioned, you know, reducing the stressor, the thing coming in to tell the brain, so the circadian rhythm and things like that, anything that's actually anti-inflammatory would help the stress response. So that's one thing that people should be thinking about. But one of the things that's been used in clinical trials, and I think there's some compelling interest in it and data, is phosphatidylserine. So phosphatidylserine is a phospholipid. Typically, the commercially available are from soy oil, soy fatty acids, and maybe sunflower fatty acids. And the idea here is what we believe is happening is that we're helping the brain and the feedback inhibition. So when the brain sees cortisol, it should shut down or it should reduce the level of the stress response. And in many cases, it doesn't do that well. And so what people think is if you create a better fluidity in the membrane in the brain, especially the hypothalamus and pituitary, that phosphatidylserine, which can help the fluidity of the membrane, perhaps other signaling mechanisms that phosphatidylserine may help, will actually help the brain see the cortisol it's already making and shut down. We mentioned that there's an enzyme that converts cortisol to cortisone. So one way to do that is to reduce the enzyme activity that produces more cortisol. And you can do that by, anti-inflammatories, because that's also something going on with inflammation, reducing insulin and insulin sensitivity, the one thing that we all forget about is exercise. Moderate exercise is a, we might call it an adaptogen. It's a mini adaptogen for the tissues. If we overexercise, if we do a marathon, if we overexert ourselves, that will then create stress. It's a very classic increase in cortisol levels. But I'm talking about moderate regular exercise. This actually creates sort of a mini stressor, or like a mini adaptogenic response, which then helps the body handle a normal stress response. They've done some studies showing that after somebody exercises, they're able to handle a stressor much better than if they were just sedentary all day. And it's because it's almost like exercising the stress response, because you're offering a stressor, but you're also offering something to use up that energy. So those are the kind of
things. In other
words,
it sort of provides the flight, from the fight or flight situation. You're actually, instead of internalizing the stress, you're actually sort of blowing it off.
Right, and that's really how the stress response is designed. You're supposed to be fighting or fleeing, And if you're just sitting in your office talking to the IRS or to your lawyer, you might be getting a lot of stress, but your body is not catabolizing or using the kind of energy that it needs to fight or flee, and therefore it's sort of hitting a brick wall. We mentioned earlier DHEA. Where DHEA is low, certainly DHEA can act as a counter-regulatory and down-regulate cortisol responses. Pregnenolone, which actually is a precursor to DHEA, taken orally, it actually doesn't go into the adrenal glands that we know of and produce more DHEA. It actually probably goes into the brain to produce either pregnenolone sulfate or DHEA or some other neurosteroids, and those then can act to downregulate cortisol because they're very effective at doing that. And while we don't need to get into the details, there are many other things that can help neurotransmitters. So people may have heard of things like GABA, serotonin, their precursors.
Tryptophan, things like that.
Tryptophan, 5-HTP. And done appropriately, and certainly we can't discuss the nuances here, but done appropriately, many of those can help balance neurotransmitters and neurosteroids. And by doing so, they help the individual then handle the stress response. And in the case of like depression, where depression oftentimes is seen with higher cortisol levels, it may be able to help modulate those and bring them down.
You also mentioned theanine as well. Do you have an opinion on that?
So theanine, which is a compound that we get from green tea, it's sort of the calming portion of the green tea. It can be used. It's often been used as to reduce anxiety, to sort of give people a sort of a meditative, contemplative sort of feel. Maybe even in some cases help them with sleep. Although it's really not a sleep aid, there isn't any any studies that I've seen on theanine specific with cortisol levels. But clearly, it would be one of those things that would often be recommended in combination with some of these other things that we mentioned for. Helping to give somebody a better state of mind, which would then lead to a lower stress or better stress adaptation.
And one herb that you don't mention that is sometimes used in stress formulas is I'm not sure, maybe you do mention it. I didn't see it in the book. Mahonia from magnolia.
So yeah, we tried to cover most everything that was in here. There are. If you look at the list of things, the magnolia and some of the extracts that are out there, and then in combination with some vitamins and minerals and some other herbs, the data on all of these, I would say, and I kind of give the level of the data that's available in the book. I would summarize it this way: we'd like to see a lot more data, and we'd like to see it in ways that are similar. In measurements and in ways that clinicians are familiar with. And so oftentimes we'll see people give perceived stress. And oftentimes we don't see measures of cortisol or DHEA changes or other sorts of measurements. One of the things that I learned in this whole project was the gamut, the wide range of research being done. Clearly, a lot of these researchers aren't talking to each other because they're using, different outcomes and different doses and different types of patients. So there's a lot more that needs to be done in this area to really summarize what we'd like to do about not about the adaptogens, but I think one that you maybe saw in there, I try to cover the data on glandulars. People still using the concentrates of adrenal gland, or even right. Some cases hypothalamus and pituitary. Probably the data doesn't sustain a really robust use of these, although there's really probably no reason to shy away from at least the adrenal glandulars. I'm not a big fan of using hypothalamus and pituitary glandulars just because using, bovine or pork brain tissue in humans doesn't seem to be overly appealing. And really there's no data to suggest that there's any sort of hormone effect that we know of. A lot of clinicians shy away from these things. I think maybe some people feel comfortable using them. But if you really look in the data, there's almost no data available to assess their efficacy. And so we kind of give a balanced approach on that. And we actually discuss the history going back to the use of both Cortex and the doula, adrenal glandulars from, you know, the original endocrine society. That was the original debate. And most people don't realize adrenaline was first a commercial name, which was designed as an extract of the adrenal gland before it became sort of more commonly used as adrenaline and noradrenaline.
Well, that's a very, very comprehensive look at the issue of stress and the HPA axis. And if you want a real deep dive into that subject, this book is for you, The Role of Stress in the HPA Axis in Chronic Disease Management. It's not for the faint of heart, but it's an excellent book that I recommend to all my fellow clinicians and informed listeners. And here's the Intelligent Medicine call to action for today. The book is available for doctors at www.thelifestylematrix.com. I'll repeat, thelifestylematrix.com. And if you're a member of the general public and you want to get a hold of it, just email orders@pointinstitute.org, orders@pointinstitute.org. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Thomas Williams, Vice President of Scientific Affairs for Orthomolecular Products. You have done a marvelous job of breaking down a very complex subject, and I really value this book.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
It's my pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.